Mr. Addington, reel three. What did the baton look like?
Well, to my astonishment, it was the most loveliest bit of jewellery I've ever seen in my life. It was about 18 inches long. It had two nuggets of gold as big as my fist each end, solid gold, and it had Hitler's signature on it to Field Marshal von Miltitz when he was presented it, when he was made Field Marshal. I don't know what day or date he was made Field Marshal, but it had black swastikas on the bottom. It was covered with blue velvet, plush blue velvet, with gold encrusted swastikas on it, and gold swastika eagles, and diamond studded as well. And now the top unscrewed, with his parchment was inside it, his promotion from Hitler, of when he was made Field Marshal. And that was the highest rank, I understand, that a man can get as a Field Marshal. Because he was taken over from Gagarin, he was called a Rick Marshal.
Where was Hitler's signature?
Hitler's signature was engraved on the top of the baton in gold, around the top here. And also in the parchment inside was Hitler's signature to the Field Marshal, Miltitz.
Did you realize it was something valuable when you got it?
Well, not really. I was just, to me, I thought myself was a bit of junk. I mustn't say that now, not knowing the value of it. But to me at the moment, I thought it was a load of junk. And I just threw it in the Jeep and carried on as usual. But I realise now that it's priceless.
But when you first got it, were you tempted to hang on to it or discard it?
Well, my first impression was I thought myself, well, I hang on to it, and I slung it in my kit bag and forgot all about it until my arrival back into this country.
Ready? So, what did you do with the baton?
Well, on my arrival back into this country, making our way back up to Scotland because we was a Scottish division, I was confronted by a lot of people. We pulled up in a pub and there was a big dance on in Elstree. I was confronted by, after the news got out, my pals had been talking after a few beers in this pub. And I was persuaded to bring the baton in and show them, and everybody went wild about it. And I was confronted, I've got a few cars that I've forgotten since. I was confronted by film directors, and goodness knows what, to do a test and photos of the baton. This is on our way to Scotland, you see. So I arrived in Scotland. I turned it down naturally. I arrived back in Scotland. And then we was given leave, and I came back home to my sister's place in Chingford, and then the baton was put in Barclays Bank vault. And it was kept there until I made my mind up to sell it. Oh, first of all, the gentleman approached me, a Mr. Mannings of Butlin's Holiday Camp. He approached me to go round to all the Butlin's holiday camps and give a running commentary on the capture and show the baton to the holiday makers. He said, "I'll give you a car, your own chauffeur," he said, "and £60 a week."
Did you accept?
No, I didn't accept.
Why not?
At that time, I had itchy feet. I wanted to get back into the army.
So you said you decided to sell it. How did you dispose of it then?
I disposed of the baton at Spinks and Sons, Duke Street, London, because they were very interested in it.
Had they already contacted you?
Yes, funnily enough, they had, which I couldn't understand. They must have got it through the papers. They wanted to buy it. So I parted with it. It was humming and ahhing over the price, and in them days, I mean, it's like £400, I mean, it was something. And they said I could get more. So I received my £400, and I got married. And then I was sent another £600 from them, making £1,000 altogether, which I got married on. But now, it's still worth it because I've got married. But I understand if I'd hung on to it, it'd have been priceless. And when I'm skipping a bit now, when I handed the baton over to my commanding officer, he said, "You'll be recommended for the MM for this brave deed." And then, which I couldn't understand, if I hand it over to the War Museum, or hand it over, I'll be presented with the MM, which I couldn't understand.
Who told you that?
Well, I was told this by the army. But I thought myself, you can't live on an MM, a medal. I mean, it's what anybody would have done, being in the right place at the right time.
So did you get the MM?
No, I wasn't interested. I was glad it was all over.
After the capture of Milch, I think there was the discovery of some atrocities that had occurred at Neustadt. Did you see anything of those atrocities?
Well, I think this Belsen camp, the atrocities, was enough. But on the actual surroundings in Neustadt, no, I didn't actually. Because Belsen was the main camp.
So you didn't see any atrocities on a beach near Neustadt?
No, because the fighting had died down on our approach to the Kiel, where the German submarines were coming in and surrendering. It was more or less a naval concern at the Kiel. But on our way to Lübeck, no, it was just, the fighting was gradually dying out. We was more or less just taking our time, regrouping, and just waiting for further orders.
You never made contact with the Russians then?
No, not actual contact. No, only stray, how can I say, stray ones, that's all. Just stray. One or two are here, but naturally they can't talk English. We knew it was a Russian, or they knew we was English on account of the uniforms, you see.
These were their reconnaissance troops, were they?
Yeah. And but not the main bulk of Russians, no, only a small reconnaissance.
Did they seem friendly to us?
Oh, very all over friendly, more friendly than ever.
How did it show itself?
Well, it showed itself, they couldn't give us enough cigarettes, which was a horrible. We'd rather smoke our own, actually, it's a terrible cigarette. They're so overwhelmed that all we could get out of them, have you got any vodka?
Did they give you any?
Well, and that's their main drink, you see, whatever they had, we shared a bottle. Because in our pack, in our travels, we had wine, which we got from German cellars, naturally.
So you were swapping cigarettes and
drinks? And trying to understand one another with hand movements and jumping up and down and going zoom, zoom, every seen any planes lately or heard and this and what have you. But afterwards, in broken English, they said the main bulk of Ruskies are behind, and they're coming forward towards us, you see. And after that, it was just straightforward going.
Did they seem well equipped?
Oh yes, well equipped, yes, well equipped.
What with?
Well, they had had mainly these grenades strapped to them. I don't know if they got them all with dead jerrys or what, but they was well equipped. They had about two rifles, or one each on shoulders, and goodness knows what. Oh, they're well equipped as regard arms.
Did they look as though they'd been through much fighting?
Well, they had, yes. They was disabled, wanted to shave for goodness knows how long. Yes, they looked as though they had it a bit rough. But I should imagine they come from the Russian front.
I think that you were once punished in the army for assaulting a colonel. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. It all happened on guard duty. And this colonel, I don't know if he'd been drinking or what, but he accused me of being filthy and not being a bright soldier. Well, that hit me very hard. I just stepped out the ranks and punched him. He fell to the ground, and I was grabbed by army escorts and waddled off to the guard room. Then I was court-martialed and accused of assault. After I explained different things, saying sorry and what have you, I was given 28 days detention. And I can tell you, detention in them days, if the army was to take over all civilian prisons and given the same treatment as the soldier had in the glass house of detention, there'd be less crime in this country. Because you had to double everywhere, you had to stand to attention. If you insulted the screw, which is the sergeant, if you insulted him, he was put on bread and water, PD1, PD2 and PD3, which is bread and butter, which is bread and water for 3 days and bread and water for 4 days. You was locked up, your braces and laces were taken away from you and all your equipment. You was allowed just your vest and short pants. You had to lay on bare boards and a log of wood for a pillar. And that was your bed. That's what they call punishment diet. And you was given bread and water twice a day only till your punishment was finished. And then you was put back into your own cell after that. Then you had to double clean rusty tins from the cookhouse. After you've got them bright, you could see your mirror, see your face in them. The screw, you used to look at it and pass them and throw them back into the water, get rusty for you to clean again the next day.
What exactly did the doubling entail?
Doubling, I mean, you had to run everywhere, quick time. If you was going from your own cell to the office or to the toilet even, you had to double. You must double. And you had to stand to attention when the screw shouted at you, the guard shouted at you, you had to stand to attention.
What if you didn't do it?
You was put on PD1 again. You was put into the punishment cell.
Were there people who still didn't cooperate after PD1?
Well, most of us did, because it was real, real hard, that was. I don't know if you ever tried to sleep on a wooden block. But we used to put our hands underneath to make it a bit softer.
Could you sleep?
No, not for the first... I didn't sleep well, not for the first week.
Were you hit by the screws?
Well, let's say this. If you didn't cooperate, you was punched in the gut. You was punched in the gut. And you had to either accept it or you didn't. You had to accept it to have an easier life. And if you cooperated, it wasn't too bad. You wasn't allowed to smoke. They were called luxuries. You wasn't allowed to read. Nothing. And the screws used to, when it was on duty at night, used to have a fag outside and blow the smoke underneath your cell door to punish you, so you'd smell the smoke and drive you nuts.
Were they big chaps?
Oh yes, they're all ex-reg caps. Ex-military police.
Was that the only time that you went to detention?
No, it wasn't actually. I got into more trouble in Cyprus.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, I can tell you. We arrived in Cyprus to guard the island against the invasion of Crete.
This was in 41, was it?
Yes, 41. We pulled out of the desert and we were sent there more or less for recuperation out of the western desert. And we arrived there, got settled in at Nicosia, that's the main town of the island. I was made sergeant, I was the general's driver. General Van Straw Benzie, I shall never forget his name, Brigadier General, I was his driver. And we was all got settled in, I was in Nissen huts and what have you. And I used to take him on tour of the island to Larnaca, Farmagusta, and up in the Carinian Mountains, all over the island. And the island was gradually all fortified, and it was full of rations in case the invasion of Crete. It was full of petrol dumps, food dumps, you name it, what have you, was there. And Nicosia, it was such a lovely place, full of girls, cabarets, dancing, and naturally, being a British squaddy, the old British soldier was always short of money. And anything coming his way was tempting to get money to go out and enjoy yourself. Well, it started when a taxi driver drove us back to camp and we never had enough ackers to pay him. So I took a tin of petrol, in them days a 4-gallon tin of petrol, and gave it to him for our fare. And he gave me money back, which I couldn't understand. There's four of us. He gave us money back and went away with a good heart because I gave him some petrol.
So that was the start of what?
That was the start of us, well, there was eight of us really. Not the magnificent seven. I suppose you'd call it a magnificent eight. There was eight of us. We got to know these taxi firms and made arrangements. I was giving them petrol for money and they was after us. And it was quite a good thing really, we was getting money and we used to go out and enjoy ourselves and actually living like lords in Nicosia on a nice cabaret there called the Sweet Melody. And after a few weeks this was carrying on. We thought, well, we've got a load of money, we better ease up. We buried all our money in biscuit tins. And as far as I know, they're there. It's there now, but naturally it's been worn away and it's been eaten away now all these years. But this particular night, we was told to lay low because the red caps were on to us.
Was that because they'd seen how you were living?
Yes, they couldn't understand and wonder where the money was coming from. So, one of our mates, he came out of hospital and he wanted money. So he had a few drinks and he said, well, I'm going to make a load. Well, what we call a load was a 3-tonner full with petrol, and that's about 1,000 gallons. So he done a load. Well, we was all against him. I said, no, we got plenty of money, no need to do that. So. And he loads the lorry up. He was on his way to this pickup where he drops it and gets his money, and the red caps caught him, surrounded him, and he was put in the guard room, that's why. So it got to the my general's ears, and the following day I was ordered to take him to identification parade. Little did I know, I was taking my own, driving him, and taking my own self to the identification parade. We was all lined up. I had to go in the ranks. And 30 taxi drivers picked me out. And hotel owners. And picked the 8 of us out, you see. Well, I looked at the general's face, he was fuming, he was. I think it was... If he could have done it there and then, he'd have shot me. We was marched away into the guard room. It was all stripped. Then we had our court-martial. And I was first to go in to receive my sentence. It was given to me. I was stripped 2 years hard labour. And I thought, oh, well, at least I'm not going to be shot. And I come in out. Coming out of the office after receiving my sentence, I bumped into a little fella. I won't name him. He said, "What did you get, Mark?" I said, "Ah, oh, 2 of the best." He thought I meant a couple of weeks CB or something. I said, "No, 2 years," and he just passed out. And then we all went in, all got our sentences. And there was an officer with us, he got stripped, a sergeant, 4 sergeants, 1 officer, and 2 bombardiers, and another lance bombardier, that's right. We all got stripped, in 2 years hard labour. We were shipped over to... yeah, we shipped over to El Marza, Egypt, the 8 of us. Now, this is a true story, I'm going to say now. If this prison was the same as every prison in this country, our crime rate would drop. The doors opened, there's a big hill in front of us. We were fully packed FSMO, full service marching order, we had all our equipment on us. And that comes to about 90 pounds of equipment on your back. We had to run up this hill, keep running up it. We couldn't make it, we rolled down, we fell to the bottom. Some who couldn't make it, with water was thrown over them, run up it again and fall, run up it again and fall. And in the end, we were shuffled through into our cells. We had to strip, check all our equipment, get it all right for the following morning inspection. Our biscuits, they are our little mattresses we sleep on, had to be 100% straight, all your equipment laid out, clean. The doors would open, he'd walk the screw. If it was no good, they used to kick it all around his cell. Then you had to straighten it all up again, and if it was okay, they let you go. Then we was taken out onto our daily routine. You can just imagine, 90, 100 degrees of heat. We were told to put our grey coats on, over our vests and short pants. We had our boots on, socks. And our pack on the back. And there, we was marched all round the square. A lot of them collapsing. I nearly went myself, the terrific heat. And there, we was one line of us line up, and double with pails of water to the end rank of another 50 of them, pour the water into their buckets, empty buckets, run back with our empty buckets, stand to attention, then the rank are come following, run to us and fill their buckets up with the water we've already put into their buckets. And this carried on a quarter of an hour. You just collapsed one after the other. You couldn't stand it. Then the water you was carrying was thrown over you by the screws to wake you up. Well, you can imagine what state you're in.
It's okay.
You can just imagine what state you're in. You've got sand under your armpits with a big heavy raincoat on you. You're itching. It was just out of... I'd rather be in thick battle than this lot.
But then this hadn't gone for 2 years, did it?
No, this carried on. This carried on for a while. I was getting used to it. And in the end, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to make it. And then I was made up to cook, head cook. I made a red band as a trusted prisoner. I was allowed to walk to the cookhouse instead of running. I was in charge of 17 cooks, and all the 8 of us were made red bands. One of my mates went in the office, he got to know when we was coming out. Another mate got made the governor of the cleaners, and so what? In the end, you're more or less running the prison. The married pads on the outside, that's the screws wives, used to send us in big pies to bake for them. And they used to put a false layer of pastry on the top with fags underneath. And then lay the fags underneath this false layer of pastry. I used to get me a cigarette supply from them. And in turn, I used to give the screws milk and what have you to take out to them. And sugar. That's how that was happening. And this particular night, the RSM happened to be coming home from a do. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when I was let out of my cell. 4 o'clock in the morning to light all the fires for the other cooks. A voice out of the blue said, "I'll make that your last bloody smoke, boy." And I was rushed away to my cell again. I lost all my equivalences, all my
privileges,
and I was rushed back to my cell. Now, this carried on, I used to think. Then the next month, we could hear the bombing getting nearer and nearer, the gunfire. This particularly must have been about 2 o'clock in the morning, all the cell doors were open. We all paraded, and we was told, right, out, finished. And then I remember running out the cell with a 303 rifle, with a bandolier of ammunition, and I landed up in the Australian Army. Goodness knows how I got into there.
Just going back to that business about assaulting the colonel, which year would that have been?
Oh, that's Colonel. Let's think.
Pre-war.
I joined up 1935, 36. 37 I went to India. This would be 36.
And where was it? Borden.
Borden, Hants, yeah.
Why did you object to him so much?
Well, I was a recruit, and I suppose I couldn't take an offence because I wasn't disciplined enough, shall we say. I mean, during the years of your training, you get disciplined, you can take assaults. But being a young red arse, I just let fly.